Physical infrastructure and human lives weren't the only casualties of Hurricane Katrina. The storm gave school officials in New Orleans an opportunity to flush away a failing public education system that had been in place for decades. Only days after the storm, the school board put the city's teachers on unpaid leave, and the city joined Washington, D.C. as one of the most heavily chartered school districts in the United States. Sarah Carr spent a full year following three key figures within that newly formed district, a teacher, a principal, and a student, and she's written about her experience in a new book called Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. It is published by Bloomsbury Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Sarah Carr, who's an education reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, to our show today. Hello.
Hi, I'm really happy to be here.
So much of your reporting is based on that fact that only days after the flood, the New Orleans School Board placed thousands of its employees on unpaid leave and then fired them a few months later. Didn't they belong to a union?
They did, but they used the circumstances of the storm to eliminate the collective bargaining agreement and to call on sort of these measures that had been put in place in case there was some sort of massive crisis to overrule that. And so you had thousands of employees who lost their homes and didn't know if they were going to be able to come back to the city that many of them had grown up on. And some of the first news they got was that they were being put on unpaid leave. They didn't know if they would see another paycheck, and then that was followed, as you point out, in subsequent months by the decision to fire them permanently.
Anybody go to court over this?
They did, and it's actually still being worked through the court system now. The last decision was actually in favor of the fired employees, but that's in the process of being appealed, and nobody knows quite how it's going to end up.
Schools were put into recovery districts. What did that classification mean for a given school?
The recovery school district was actually created before Katrina, and it was an allusion to recovery from academic failure. A lot of people think that it refers to Hurricane Katrina, but they changed the threshold for what type of school could be put into the recovery school district after Katrina in a way that allowed them to put pretty much all of the public schools in the city in that district. And that was done with the idea of chartering them as quickly as possible.
People often see crisis as an opportunity to affect changes that you might not be able to affect otherwise.
Yeah,
but here
exactly.
We are in a situation where there's all this confusion in the days after the storm with reports of looting and questions about whether or not the city was under martial law. And pretty much the first thing that's addressed is educational reform.
Yeah, no, as you point out, there were a group of key leaders, mostly at the state level, who had been frustrated with the performance of the city school system for years. And most of them had evacuated to Baton Rouge and sort of in a series of meetings were laying the stage for what was basically kind of a coup to take over the school system.
And how did the board go about dismantling the schools? Were they immediately turned into charter schools?
They weren't. Actually, there were a lot of officials who'd hoped to charter them all right away, but there weren't enough promising charter operators who applied in the early rounds. So the state found itself running more schools than it had anticipated directly for actually a matter of years, and it's sort of been it's been a more gradual process than some had thought it would be, but now about 80% of the schools are charters in New Orleans, and it's expected to go to 90 to 100% in the next couple of years.
Have there been any accusations of shady dealings between politicians and charter school administrators?
There have been some. The charters in New Orleans really run the gamut in terms of their transparency. There have been cases, you know, a few years ago, there was a CFO of a charter who, it turned out, had embezzled hundreds of thousands of dollars. But there are others that are incredibly transparent. And so it's hard to generalize. But there have been definitely some isolated cases of corruption.
You say that, I'm quoting, when the first large wave of recovery district schools reopened after Katrina, the number of teachers across the public schools dropped from about 4,000 to 1,100. Yet you say that few of those 3,000 teachers try to get their jobs back.
Yeah, I mean, some of them did, but a lot of them, you know, if you just sort of lost your home and everything that you've worked for and are living in another city, and then it's a slap in the face to be fired en masse, a lot of them didn't even want to come back and try. And they also instituted a basic skills test that teachers had to pass, and most of them who reapplied were able to pass that, but there was a certain percentage who weren't.
And was one of the advantages for the board to place schools in the hands of private charters that they would get past the unions? They would no longer have to deal with labor disputes?
That was definitely a motivating factor for some people. State laws differ, but in Louisiana, charter schools cannot be unionized and cannot have collective bargaining. So by saying that they were going to charter the system over time, that was de facto a way of keeping the union from really gaining traction again in the city.
How far were you into the story before your employer, the Times-Picayune, ceased putting out a daily newspaper and laid off many of its staff members?
You know, that actually happened after I'd written the book. It happened sort of in the final stages of editing and publishing the book. But there are people who've compared in some ways what happened to the schools.
Well, it looks like a trend.
Yeah. Even though it's still, the Times-Picayune is still run by the same company in a lot of ways, it was sort of this takeover and this decision to kind of gut the more experienced employees and bring in reporters with a lot less experience who could be paid less.
Does anyone dispute the fact that the New Orleans school district was in really shabby shape before Hurricane Katrina?
I think it's hard to dispute that by the numbers. I mean, the significant majority of schools were not sort of meeting the basic threshold that they needed to on the state tests, and the rates of students who were going on to college were just abysmal. But I think that sometimes the people who've led the push for changes forget the number of bright spots that did exist. There was a lot of great work being done in pockets before Katrina, and that shouldn't be overlooked.
And you say there's a story about a valedictorian from the pre-Katrina era that had become something of a cliche among those who follow education in New Orleans. What happened?
It was the valedictorian of a neighborhood high school in New Orleans who tried repeatedly to pass the state's exit exam and failed. And I personally take umbrage with the way that story has been used, just because at this point, this young lady is in her late 20s and has gone on to kind of live a life. And I actually connected with her the other day, and it turns out she did over time earn her college diploma. And I think that the reasons that happened were really complicated, and that it's sort of time to move past that story and start comparing the schools to what they need to become.
But that was seen as a justification for
changing things.
That
was definitely sort of one of the poster child cases that people kept citing over and over.
My guest is Sarah Carr. Her book, Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. It's published by Bloomsbury Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Louisiana has a college scholarship program where students who score above the state average on the ACT and keep their GPA above a 2.5 receive a scholarship to any of the state's public universities. Isn't a 2.5 a rather low bar?
It is. I think it's great that the scholarship program exists at all, but you're right that it's not a particularly high bar.
Well, does that reflect how poorly the schools were performing throughout the state?
I think that probably if you're looking at sort of state-by-state comparisons, the ACT is a better metric to use than the GPA, since those are so subjective and can vary so much from school to school.
What about the student you followed, Gerald Lynn? Did she fall within the guidelines?
Gerald Lynn is in her junior year of high school, so it's unclear exactly where her GPA and ACT scores will end up. I think she'll probably make that cutoff. I think her GPA right now is above a 3.0, and she's on track. She's been improving a lot on the practice ACT tests that she's taken, so she'll probably meet that bar.
And how did you come to pick her out of all the students in the New Orleans school system?
I knew I wanted to follow a student at the particular high school that was starting as she began her freshman year, and I went out and spoke with dozens of families, and I guess I was looking for a student who could go either way. I didn't want to follow one who was, you could sort of tell, wasn't going to make it, but I didn't want to follow the one who was the star student of their class. And beyond that, I just connected with Gerald Lynn and her mother, and they were very open to having their story told.
Well, you've said that you wanted this book to attempt to humanize a story that's been recklessly politicized.
Yeah,
that's why you're telling these stories of these people?
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like sort of the extremes in the conversation about education reform have hijacked a lot of the conversation. And, you know, just being in New Orleans, so much of the reporting has been about the leadership and Paul Vallis, who used to run the recovery school district. But I don't think that there's been enough about the families and educators who are affected. And so I wanted to tell their story.
Do you think that being in these classrooms and Gerald Lynn's and the teacher you followed as well had an impact on the way the classes behaved? And were Gerald Lynn's classmates, did they tease her because there was this reporter following her around?
You know, I spent so much time at that school that I was kind of part of the scenery. And so I think they forgot about my presence over time, and there was just so much else kind of going on. I mean, that school had a lot of struggles the year I was there that it was kind of easy for people to forget that I was there. I mean, Gerald Lynn, I think, was sometimes conscious of it, and she would make occasional references to kind of moderating her behavior in little ways when she knew I was around. But I don't think in sort of a big picture sense that I really affected her trajectory or path.
You say that the debate over John A. Craig Elementary, an underperforming public-run school that some were proposing to turn into a charter, framed your understanding of the conflict over urban education across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not just a New Orleans story, because we have a debate constantly in this city over whether underperforming schools should be changed into charter schools.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think that the New Orleans debate and the debate over Craig specifically sort of spoke to whether or not sort of school reform and sort of community uplift more generally should emanate from within a community, or whether it's okay for it to be imposed from the outside. And I think that sort of tension is what's fueling a lot of the debates about charter schools, not only in New Orleans, but New York, sort of the extent to which reform must be self-determined by a community.
One side of the debate seems to support charters because of the influx of money and the impact that can have on turning a school around. The other side opposes charters because they say that those schools emphasize practices put in place that appeal to the white power structure. And in a city like New Orleans, which is majority black still after Katrina?
It is. It's about 60% African American. And it's become slightly whiter overall since Katrina. But, you did see this demographic shift in the teaching force. I mean, every year, pretty much the percentage of white teachers goes up by a modest amount. And so I think that's fueling some of the tension, in that you had sort of this action where all of these educators who were 70% African American lost their jobs, and then you have them being displaced by a teaching force that is far more white than the pre-Katrina one was. And so there's no doubt that sort of racial cast is over all of this.
And this doesn't just apply to schools. There was a documentary not long after Katrina about how some projects that really had not been affected by Katrina but were in a very valuable part of town were suddenly boarded up and then raised so that fancier housing could be put in its place.
Yeah.
Which was a way of saying we want to replace the poor black people with more affluent white people.
Yeah, no, it really is sort of part and parcel of the whole debate about gentrification, not only in New Orleans, but in New York and other places as well.
Is this despite the fact that the mayor now in trouble, the mayor at the time, was black?
You know, the mayor has not really had much direct relationship with the schools in New Orleans. I mean, in New York, it's a much different story, but the mayor's had a lot of drama going on in in his story, and particularly right now, but the connection to the schools isn't that tight.
Well, studies indicate that 85% of the students in the New Orleans public school system come from low-income families.
Mm-hmm.
Since the population isn't 85% low-income, where are those other kids going? Are they all going to private schools? Have they all always gone to private schools, the white kids?
Pretty much since the schools were desegregated, yes. New Orleans had sort of one of the most wholesale and quickest paces of white flight in the 1960s and 1970s, and it has one of the highest, if not the highest, rates of private school attendance in the country. There are also a few magnet programs within the public system that middle-class white families have historically sent their students to, and which they still do. But I think there are some people who hoped that the chartering of the system would bring back more middle-class white families, and I don't think that's happened at any significant rate yet. I think most of them are still at a few of these magnet schools or in the private system.
Are people still traumatized because of the aftermath of Katrina?
Sure. I mean, I don't...
What about these kids who have had their lives disrupted and now mm-hmm. have this whole change in their school system?
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, I think it's something that will affect them in ways both visible and unseen for their entire lives. You don't go through that kind of trauma and not have it linger. I mean, at one of the schools I followed, there was a busload of kids that arrived one morning and found out that there had been a fire at their building overnight. And the administrators, after they went and talked to the students on the bus, came off and said it was sort of like another mini Katrina, and that they were wondering what this meant for them and were they going to be able to go back to their school. And so I think their sort of threshold for fear is a lot lower, that there could be some sort of traumatic event that changes their entire lives.
My guest is Sarah Carr, who's written about education for the past 12 years. She's written a book now called Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. You say America's children here, not New Orleans children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and it's exactly what we were talking about earlier, that I think a lot of the debates and tensions in New Orleans are really evocative of ones that are happening in cities across America.
The book is published by Bloomsbury Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Sarah Carr, who's written a book called Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. It's published by Bloomsbury. You write that although Gerald Lynn's family was far from rich, her parents were fairly engaged in her education. Isn't parental involvement one of the key differences between children who are successful in school and those who aren't?
I think it is in a lot of cases, and I think that's a major reason that Gerald Lynn has been relatively successful, is that she has a mother and a stepfather who are really keeping tabs on her and who make it clear to her how much they value education and, despite working crazy schedules at times, make a lot of time for her.
How did Gerald Lynn and her family come to learn about KIPP charter schools?
They returned a few months after Katrina to New Orleans, and I think Gerald Lynn ran into one of her former teachers who was now working for KIPP, and he connected them, and then the principal came over for an in-person visit and explained the program, and in particular, it appealed to Gerald Lynn's mother. She wasn't so excited about it initially, but it was through that in-person visit by the principal.
But it sounds kind of by chance. In the weeks after the school board made the changes, whose responsibility was it to inform the parents about the change and get the kids into the classes?
That was one of the problems the first couple of years after Katrina, is that really wasn't happening enough, and that it was sort of just in little pockets. You had principals like that one from KIPP who were being very aggressive and going out and trying to make contact with families and recruit children, but you had other families who really fell through the cracks and who either sort of didn't even enroll their kids for months or years, or ended up at the very weakest performing schools.
Because also people were scattered across the city, in fact, scattered across states in some cases, but
yeah.
They no longer were in the same school district that they had been in before the storm.
Yes, and a lot of them, I mean, it really had no idea sort of what a charter school was, or more people, I think, had a sense of what had happened to the teachers, just because so many people knew teachers personally, and so it was hard to escape the fact that they had all lost their jobs. But there was this widespread confusion about what had happened to the schools that they grew up with.
Were there applications or interviews for the new schools?
At most of them, no. I mean, that's one of the concerns that's often cited about charters, is that they find ways of screening or just taking the better performing students. And I think in New Orleans, it was somewhat of a mixed bag, in that you had some charter operators that did probably try to do that informally, but others that really were open to all.
They want the better students because then they look better when they're presenting their case.
Yeah, you know, ones that sort of haven't had a chronic behavior problems, or ones that, as you mentioned, have sort of the more involved, motivated families, ones who are not coming in with a record of academic failure. Since so much in New Orleans and elsewhere is increasingly based on test scores, and if schools don't meet the bar in terms of their test scores, they're basically shut down.
The teacher you followed, Aidan Kelly, came to New Orleans through Teach for America. Mm-hmm. Had he studied to become a teacher? Had he taken ed courses?
No. He was someone who hadn't really thought in college about being a teacher. He had thought about being a college professor, but not about teaching at the K-12 level. And he went to an informational session with a Teach for America recruiter who was just a couple of years older than him, and just really kind of bought into their mission after that meeting and started pursuing teaching as a result of the Teach for America component.
Is he typical of the kind of teacher New Orleans is trying to attract?
He is, in a lot of ways, and that's sort of been a part of the tension, is that there's been a big influx of teachers coming from out of town, ones who are either Teach for America core members or recent alums of the program, and who are coming from across the country and may never have been to New Orleans before. And so there's definite trade-offs in that they bring a lot of enthusiasm, and they bring kind of the motivation to work 70 or 80 hours a week, but they do not know much about New Orleans or New Orleans students, and grew up in a very different social and cultural context than the students that they're trying to educate.
Well, the new group of teachers that he was part of at his school, Psi Academy, mm-hmm. Charter school, were white, Ivy League educated, their mid-20s. I would think that there would be a bit of a problem, even if they were black, in relating to these kids who had grown up in New Orleans.
Yes. In fact, you know, there was the year that I spent so much time there, there were a couple of black teachers, and one of them was from New York and was an alum of Yale. And he made that exact same point, that it wasn't like just because he was black, he could therefore relate to the kids, that he grew up in a very different place and in very different circumstances. And in some ways, the kids had grown so used to having these young white teachers that they viewed him as even more alien.
But these are also teachers with little classroom experience. Mm-hmm. I know from the few attempts I made after I left college mm-hmm. to even consider teaching that classroom experience is incredibly important, just in keeping the class quiet,
yeah,
if nothing
yeah.
else.
And I think that's one of the reasons that charter schools like Psi rely so much on this very routinized, structured approach.
Almost militaristic, it sounds.
Yes, at times, because they kind of need that, because they don't sort of have the more informal classroom management skills that you get just with experience and through building relationships with kids.
And you said that Aidan and other teachers at Psi and other schools work 80-hour weeks? Do they get paid overtime?
I mean, definitely in their first years, they work 70 to 90 hours a week, I think.
Why is so much time required? After all, school is 9 to 3.
You know, that's a great question, and that's exactly kind of one of the first things I asked Aidan. And they do have a longer school day, so he was usually there from about 6:30 to 6:30, so that's 12 hours at the school. And they have the policy that teachers have to be accessible until 9 p.m. Via phone if students have questions with their schoolwork. But he told me that the single biggest difference initially was lesson planning time, and that he would basically spend many late evenings and the whole weekend planning his lessons because they had such detailed requirements for what needed to be in a lesson.
And you say he didn't feel all that appreciated.
I don't think it was that he didn't feel appreciated. I think that in his first months at SCI, he just felt overwhelmed and like he was sort of constantly running and not getting anywhere. But I think actually one of the plus sides about SCI is that it is a very strong school culture and climate among the teachers, and that they are very supportive of each other.
Well, SCI and KIPP, as you say, have very tight rules.
Mm-hmm.
But you also say that one teacher told you that they don't acknowledge things that don't lead to college.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work? Is that the only emphasized goal in these schools, to get kids thinking about or prepared for college?
That is the main one. And, you know, as I wrote in the book, they're kind of kids as young as 3 or 4 will start doing college chants before they're even able to read. And at SCI, they had each student's ACT scores at one point displayed sort of beside examples of colleges that might accept them based on the results. So they don't mince words, or they're not shy about that goal.
But what about kids who are unlikely to go to college? Do they just fall through the cracks?
There are a few students. SCI is now at the point where it's graduating its first classes of students and sending them on to college. And there are a few I know who've had intense special needs who've gone on to community college programs. But I think kind of thinking broadly about the New Orleans school landscape, that is a big issue, in that there's a lot of demand by employers for kids with technical skills and a lot of high-paid jobs in that area, and a lot of kids who maybe are turned off by this idea of just a completely college prep curriculum. And so I do think that as the school system evolves there, it needs to develop a broader array of programs so that kids who might not fit that kind of mold have other options available to them.
I'm talking with Sarah Carr. Her book, Hope Against Hope, 3 Schools, 1 City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. The third person you followed through the district seems to have a slightly different approach. Can you tell us about Marie Laurie?
Sure. Mary Laurie.
It's Mary, not Marie.
Yeah. She's not a native New Orleanian, but she moved there when she was very young from the Mississippi Delta. And she was a product of the New Orleans public school system. She was in the one of the first. She was in one of the first classes at a high school to integrate. She was, I think, one of the first 5 African American students who graduated from that school. And she worked her way up very gradually and over time through the school system there. It took her 10 years to get her bachelor's degree because she was a single mother working full time while she went to college. And then she worked as a teacher and then as a principal before Katrina, and then took over a school that chartered immediately after Katrina. And she has sort of a very different approach and mentality about school reform than a lot of the folks who've come to operate and teach in schools since the flood.
Well, she has 2 sons who've been through the school system as well.
Yes, she has 4 sons, and all of them went through the school system. 2 of them were murdered. And so that's given her a huge amount of empathy in working through tragedies and crisis with the families that she works with now.
So how has the Board of Education responded to her approach, which seems almost holistic? Her school, O. Perry Walker High, has a health clinic and social workers, obviously growing out of what she has learned through her experience. But is that community-based approach the exception or the norm?
I think increasingly it's becoming the exception in New Orleans. I mean, to clarify, most of the schools there have social workers. And actually, O. Perry Walker recently lost its health clinic, which was unfortunate.
Because of budgetary cuts.
They had a grant, I think, that wasn't renewed, and so they had to close down the health clinic. But I think that increasingly Psy is becoming, Psy Academy, the school where Aiden teaches, is becoming much more the norm, and that the schools, kind of broadly speaking, are very KIPP-like in that they're very, very structured and focused on this goal of college matriculation and graduation.
And Aiden Kelly talks about the constant pressure from his principal because of the top-down approach at Psy. Teachers basically responsible for everything inside the classroom, and it's their job to fix any problems. What are the advantages and disadvantages of running a school that way? Is it even realistic?
Well, I think it's sort of a broader thing that was one of my biggest concerns about what's happened in New Orleans, is that it's not entirely intentionally, but they've kind of put sort of the fate of the whole city on the schools, and they've sort of left it to the schools to address sort of all of these broader challenges. And it's very hard in a city where you kind of have all a broken criminal justice system and a broken healthcare system and few recreational opportunities for kids and one of the nation's highest rates of gun violence to say, you know, do it all in the classroom. And so I think that moving forward, the approach has to be a lot more holistic in New Orleans and other cities as well, or it's going to be very hard to revitalize a place like that in the long term.
Since these charter schools try not to take in very many special needs children, where do they go? Mm-hmm. Where do autistic kids go and LD kids?
There are, just to clarify, there are some charters that are very open and accessible for special needs children, but there are a lot of others that aren't. And that's a big concern moving forward, is that the rates of students, particularly with severe special needs like high levels of autism, have been much higher in the non-charter schools. But as the number of non-charter schools dwindles, that's the question, is where are these kids going to go, and are the charters that haven't so far really going to be opening their doors to these students in large numbers?
Well, 38% of the students with autism are in charters, but that's one-third, 37% with emotional disturbances, 23% with multiple disabilities. Mm-hmm. And you also spoke with a number of students who felt as if they were driven out of the school system.
That's been another issue, and not just for students with severe special needs, but one sort of for who are chronically getting in trouble and maybe being more disruptive in classes than their teachers would ideally like. You just see a lot of kind of informal, off-the-books efforts to force out or expel students that aren't being captured in the numbers. And since the system is so decentralized and there's no sort of centralized student-level tracking system, schools can get away with that much more easily. And so I do worry moving forward that there's going to be kids who are just out of school completely, who aren't attending any educational environment regularly, and that are some of the highest needs.
Well, in just a few seconds, do you think that do most people see this new system as an improvement?
Oh, gosh. That's an impossible question, because there's been so much progress, but there's so many challenges that remain.
Sarah Carr will be part of a panel discussion about urban education in America tonight at 7 o'clock at Teachers College. That's at 525 West 120th Street. Her book, Hope Against Hope, published by Bloomsbury. And on tomorrow's show, New Yorker staff writer Jeffrey Toobin discusses Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her lasting impact on the High Court. And then David Henry Hwang talks about The Dance and the Railroad, the second production of his year-long residency at the Signature Theater Company. We'll also look at Guggenheim Partners. The company has bought the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Hollywood Reporter, but remains incredibly secretive. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Iggins, the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. We had help today from Matthew McDonough, Keith Karn, Sarah Walchuk, and contributing producer Fran Jacobs. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.